Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in European Studies. I'm Tim Jones, and my guests today are Malte Dold and Tim Krieger, co-editors of Ordoliberalism and European Economic Policy, Between Realpolitik and Economic Utopia, published as a paperback in April by Routledge. Described in a 2017 book title as a German oddity, Ordoliberalism was, as Stefan Kolev writes in this latest volume, one of a number of neoliberalisms that emerged out of the political maelstrom of the interwar period. Unlike the other liberal splinters, ordoliberalism, founded at the University of Freiburg by economist Walter Eucken and jurist Franz Böhm, was quickly tested in the real world. The Germany rebuilt out of the ashes of war was founded on its principles: rules-based economics, independent agencies protected from politics, and the state as arbiter. The West German economic miracle followed by the successive reunification were a testament to ordoliberalism's effectiveness. As the European community became a union and created the euro, the other members were keener to import the success than the rules. When crisis struck from 2008 onwards, Europe's rules-based approach was severely stress-tested and continues to be during the pandemic. Is this crisis due to ordoliberalism's failings or a sign of its success? Can and should ordoliberalism adapt and survive? These are some of the questions asked and answered in this collection of essays by leading ordos and ordo-skeptics. My guests today are definitely in the first category. Malte Dold is an assistant professor of economics at Pomona College in California, with a master's from Bayreuth and a PhD from Freiburg. Currently at Freiburg, Tim Krieger is professor of constitutional political economy, with a master's from Kiel and a PhD from Munich. Tim and Malte, welcome to the podcast.
Well, hi, Tim. Thanks for having us.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having us.
Definitely.
Well, before we get into the book, I'd like to start by defining the term ordoliberalism. But between you, could you explain what it is, tell the story of how it emerged in Freiburg and spread, and how it differs from the other new forms of liberalism that emerged after the First War?
Yeah, maybe I can answer that question because I'm part of the Freiburg School, and the Freiburg School basically goes back to the 1930s, 1940s, when it was founded as one of several neoliberal schools that evolved in that time or emerged in that time, like in Chicago, London, and Vienna. And it was actually only later called Ordoliberal School because there was this journal called Ordo, which was published by Walter Eucken and some other prominent scholars from Freiburg and elsewhere. And so in the 1950s, roughly, it started to be called Ordoliberalism. And there are some similarities with these other neoliberalisms, as you mentioned, but on the other hand, there are also some differences. First of all, historically, the idea was that all these neoliberalisms wanted to resolve some of the problems of laissez-faire liberalism, especially the problem that unrestricted competition can lead to a concentration of economic and political powers in the hands of a small group of people. And this was something that was possible in laissez-faire liberalism because the state or the government was not supposed to play any role in the markets. And the new neoliberalisms, and especially the ordoliberals, said, okay, we need to have a much stronger role of the government in safeguarding the competitive order. Okay, so the idea was not so much to say we allow the government interventions into the markets, but the idea was to have rules for markets, which was then called by the Freiburg School the constitution for the markets. And this includes, for example, antitrust legislation. Today, we would probably call this simply market institutions. But in Freiburg, there was always this group of economists and lawyers or law professors who were working together. And this led to this strong emphasis of legal rules, of constitutions, and which was later actually found again in James Buchanan's work and in the Virginia School, who were doing constitutional economics. And James Buchanan was actually the honorary president of the Walter Eucken Institute in Freiburg for a very long time because of that. And so this is there are some linkages between these groups and especially this emphasis of legal rules and constitutions that was kind of specific to the Freiburg School. And it was all about this restricting economic power concentrations, political power concentrations, which were, by the way, very important for the Freiburg people because they were part of the resistance movement against the Nazi dictatorship in the 1930s and 40s. And so they had personal experiences of oppression, and therefore they were also very political thinkers.
And the people you described there, there's the sort of German wing of ordoliberalism and then the spread to the Chicago School and to people like James Buchanan. I think many people would associate at least most of those people as being on the right of politics. Is there an ordoliberalism of the left or the center? I mean, I know some of your writers touch on this sort of social, the marrying of social policy and economic policy. Is it something that has become associated with the right or is correctly associated with the political right?
Yeah, maybe yeah, I give it a try here. So you're absolutely right in, if you look at the sociology of auto-liberals and auto-liberal professors in post-World War II Germany, that there was a, let's say, center-right leaning of those professors that were following in the footsteps of those earlier auto-liberals. And you could even look at those interwar auto-liberals that were part of a larger, group of neoliberals that met, in the 30s, in the late 30s, in the Colloque Walter Lippmann, right, in Paris. Mm-hmm. And there was always that, affiliation with a center-right, slightly conservative, political wing. But interestingly, and I think that is, contested in contemporary scholarship on auto-liberalism, the question is always, is it found in the original ideas, for example, of Walter Eucken, right? Is there something inherently conservative in the ideas? And Tim and I, we tend to think that that's an open question. And it's more of a historical sociological development that happened then and not necessarily linked to those original ideas. And interestingly, Walter Eucken, starts one of his famous books that was posthumously published in 52 with the social question. So basically economics is not first, the social question is first. And what he means by social question is questions of, social justice. And if you start with that question, quite frankly, it's an open debate whether that's really a center-right starting point. Now, just one more point on that, and I think that maybe leads us to some of the contemporary discussions. Apart from what Tim just said, that power and the dispersion of power was a very important point of the early auto-liberals, nowadays, often auto-liberalism, there's a shortcut thinking that auto-liberalism equates thinking in rules and, you know, the strict adherence to rules. And if you have that very shortcut reading, you could come to the conclusion and think, well, it's all about austerity policies. It's all about those typically affiliated with more conservative, also, you know, Chicago school economists like Friedman, like Buchanan and others. But we, at least in our book and in our writings, Tim and I, we tend to say that it's very much an open question whether that there's a necessary link between auto-liberalism and conservatism and center-right politics.
Yeah, and I did finally identify the two chapters I was referring to towards the end of the book, To Walk Before Your Conclusion. The chapters by Julian Dürr, Niels Goldschmidt, and Alexander Langer, and the one by Bridget Young, where they talk about the social market economy side, the need for stronger cohesion policy, and the tradition from Alfred Müller Armack onwards of trying to marry auto-liberalism and modern social policy, I guess with the idea of creating a buy-in for all social groups and therefore buying social peace. Is that, well, I guess we could come to it later, but is that a tradition that developed later in auto-liberalism, or was that element always there right from the beginning?
Well, I would say this is something that was there from the beginning. I mean, and this started with a social question that Malte just mentioned, and there is, of course, this strong influence of the Freiburg School on the development of the social market economy in Germany, and so this is also in some of the chapters of the book. You can really see how these let's say market based thinking of the Freiburg School, which was always open to the social question, merged with some social Catholic thinking by others in the German post World War society, and bringing these two things together then led to this idea of a social market economy. And that was something that evolved over time. What happened then later was basically that, at least that's my interpretation, some of the auto-liberal scholars became more conservative again. And especially when there was this paradigm shift in the 1970s, 1980s, towards more supply-side economics. And that was embraced by some of the German auto-liberal professors that were around. And that is basically shaping the picture that we have, or that some people at least have nowadays, of what auto-liberalism is. So it was more social in a sense in the beginning, and then it became more conservative over time. And now the younger scholars and the ones you mentioned in the book, like Niels Goldschmidt and Brigitte Young, they are moving back basically to the roots of these social ideas by the early auto-liberals.
Right. Well, coming to the book now, it was based on a workshop you called in 2016. What prompted you to call that workshop? How did it develop into a book, and how did you get Wolfgang Schäuble to write the preface? Was that a difficult process?
Well, let me start with the origins of the book and this workshop. There was actually a workshop before that was organized by Josef Hien, who is also participating in our book and contributed a chapter, and Christian Jürges, that took place in Berlin, and I went there and presented a paper that Malte and I did. And I met a couple of these people that we later invited to our workshop. And it was really fascinating to see this discussion, because there were really auto skeptics all around, and very few who were still supporting auto liberalism. And it was interesting, it was a lot of lawyers who were still supporting auto liberalism. And I thought, well, that's a nice idea to bring this to Freiburg. And we had the 75th birthday of a major donor of the Freiburg University, and who is strongly interested in auto-liberalism. And so I thought, let's have a little workshop to honor this donor. And so that is how things evolved. And then we asked Lars Feld and Volker Berghahn, Brigitte Young, and others, even Werner Bonefeld, who's really an ordo skeptic. and they all came, and it was a great event. And everything evolved from that, basically. And we had a lecture series then in the next semester, where we invited Kenneth Dyson and many other people, and then the word spread somehow, and we decided to have this volume, and suddenly some people like Ottmar Issing gave us a call and asked, well, can I also contribute a chapter? And we said, wow, this is great. All these really interesting people, Rüdiger Bachmann, Michael Wohlgemuth, and so on. So they all wanted to participate. And so we ended up with many more chapters and contributors than we initially had in this workshop. And it was wonderful. And at the end of the day, I mean, we simply ask Wolfgang Schäuble basically by writing him a letter, and he is an alumnus from Freiburg University, and he's very open to this kind of thing, to support his old university, and so he immediately agreed basically to write this foreword to our volume.
If I can jump in here. I mean, the interesting thing is, apart from what Tim just said, that also the broader debate at the time, right, before 2016, there were many voices in Anglo-Saxon, Anglo-American media and in academia that published very critical articles about ordoliberalism in connection to the European economic crisis that was still lingering on at the time. And the interesting thing was that neither some of the German critics nor those international critics really engaged on a deeper level with contemporary ordoliberal scholarship. And we said, there was basically this gap, and we said we need to do something that is for an international audience also ultimately, and publish then something in English. And I think that was, correct me if I'm wrong, Tim, but something that was also out there on a broader scale that motivated this project.
Oh, no, it certainly was. And we're mixing up the Tims now. I knew that would happen. It certainly was out there. And I see that the two of you on Twitter were suggesting having a follow-up workshop once the pandemic is over in Freiburg, maybe at the end of this year or early next year. Is it really that you want to follow up with obviously the huge change in circumstances since 2016 and even since the publishing of the book, with the significant changes in economic policy due to the pandemic?
We haven't really thought about the pandemic issue, but our idea was to bring together younger scholars who are interested in ordoliberalism, because I mean there is this bias that also in the book, many of these scholars who contributed are already a little bit older, established professors, or some of them even retired professors. And we thought, because we got so much positive feedback from, especially from younger scholars, that we thought, okay, we need to do something where the old guys basically are not the ones who are presenting the papers, who are advancing the new ideas, but maybe just comment on that, but let the younger guys do the work, present their ideas. And I don't know whether we really came up with an age limit, but I would say like 45 or 40 or something like that. So people should be young, and there are some people around who are working on these issues, and we really want to give them a podium or an audience to present their ideas, and then maybe have a nice workshop on that. And publish another book. I don't know. We're not at that point yet, but that's the idea.
Well, yeah, I'll look forward to that. there are so many strands to the book, so it's difficult to know where to start. But I'll probably start with Kenneth Dyson's chapter, where he concludes that the crisis may have corresponded in substantial part with ordoliberalism, but they were not caused by ordoliberalism. And his thesis is that the origins of the crisis were systemic. In other words, monetary union was born with too few creditor states and too many debtor states. Do you think that is that something you would agree with?
That's a really good question. Maybe I can answer that or try at least. I think it's the origins of the crisis are systemic, but I would provide a different explanation than Kenneth Dyson is doing, because I think Dyson's argument is somewhat too static in this case. I mean, what he does is he basically states, okay, in the beginning there is a fixed set of states that are involved, and there are not enough creditor states in the sense of somehow redistributing resources from the creditor states to the debtor states. And this is in a sense, if that would be the case, you would probably never start with something like a monetary union. What you basically expect is that something is going to happen in a dynamic sense, that that the monetary union would be so economically successful that all countries would actually benefit from that. And the problem was that usually, I mean, this you would really expect that this is going to happen, but these positive and dynamic adjustment processes did not take place in the EMU for a long time. I mean, they stopped in 2008. Up to that point, I would say this was really kind of successful system, and then the problem started. And my explanation was that these adjustment processes, they were not complete, they were not sufficient. There was not really a sustainable catch-up process of some of the southern European countries. There were also too little new innovations in economically weaker states that would help to generate this kind of catch-up process. Although there was, of course, an extensive subsidization through European funds, and there was also very little internal migration. So the preconditions for what the economists then call an optimal currency area were hardly fulfilled. And there is a second problem with that, and that is what Johannes Becker and Clemens Fuest in their chapter described. That is this fundamental commitment problem, that the countries could not commit to following the rules they agreed to. And I mean, these rules were fair weather rules, and it was also basically fair weather politics. But as soon as there was a country facing an economic problem or an asymmetric shock, this country was no longer willing to follow the rules. The incentives were just too strong to breach the rules. And I'm not saying this because of the southern European countries being a problem. But I mean, it was Germany and France who were the first countries to ignore the deficit criterion of the Maastricht Treaty. And so the rules, and that's the ordoliberal take, of course, the rules were not sufficient for setting up this kind of monetary union, which was not an optimal currency area. And we would have needed a different institutional setting to come up with this kind of union.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
I thought the chapter by, on, in that respect, I thought the chapter by Thomas Biebercher was very interesting, because he has this view that there is a tendency towards order liberalism of the Eurozone, given the emerging link between risk, liability, and market exit. And I'm very interested to hear your views on this, but I suspect this is correct, that that while the original design was not fit for purpose, the challenges of, first of all, the negative overspill from the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy, then the sovereign debt crisis, then the triggering of the doom loop between the banks and the sovereigns, and now the impact of the pandemic, has essentially forced adaptation, and that maybe not next time, I mean, probably next time, maybe not next time, but the time after, the Eurozone will be fit for purpose. And as he points out, the missing piece in his view is an explicit sovereign insolvency procedure. But I would argue that there is already an implicit procedure there with the collective action clauses in the bonds, the revised European Stability Mechanism Treaty. I'm very interested to hear the views of the two of you, whether you share that ordo-optimistic view of Biebercher or whether you are more pessimistic.
Maybe I go briefly first, but Tim can then go second. So I, in a sense, I hope you're right that, you know, we have learned from the past, and both in terms of, you know, what type of, you know, economic reasoning we enshrine into our rules on the European level. And on the other hand, also in terms of that, you know, democracy deficit that we sometimes have when it comes to economic policy making. Personally, I have my doubt because the next crisis will be different. I hope that, you know, we have learned from this severe crisis, obviously, and that whether we call them order liberal or whether we call them economically sensible rules, I don't care, actually. As I said, I hope you're right.
I totally agree with Malte on that point. I would also say, I mean, it's we've done a couple of steps now, like the banking union and all these other support instruments that we introduced now. So I'm not so much concerned that we're going to see the same kind of crisis again. Something has changed there. There is a better understanding of the problems. And of course, I mean, it takes a long time. It's a very complicated political process, because it is also about sharing some debt, some liabilities, economic harms in a way that would not happen for all the countries if they were completely independent. So as long as we basically decide to live in a European Union for reasons that are not purely economic, I guess we always face this issue that we need to respond to certain challenges that come up that are new, and we will probably never come up with a perfect institutional setting for that because of these new challenges that we are having difficulties to anticipate. But as Malte said, I mean, if we would be at least sensible enough to really think about economic consequences and try to anticipate what could happen and not to wait until the last moment and then the problem is there and then we have to negotiate and about these things, about burden sharing in a sense, when you know already who are the winners and who are the losers. Because then things are getting really complicated. And that's what we've seen of the financial crisis. I mean, it was really difficult. It took years to come up with this solution. And it's basically a solution only for future crises that may come up. So we are setting up institutions for the future, but not for resolving basically what has happened in, for example, the financial crisis, or maybe now during the pandemic. And just thinking more in terms of what would be a good institutional setting that is sensible to economic questions, to incentives that arise, would already help, I would say.
Mm. Do you not think sometimes maybe you're being a little harsh in that if you look at the crisis countries, I mean, the countries that actually had to take programs, so not France, not Italy, but Spain, Ireland, Portugal, Greece, all these countries, while, you know, your typical order might have wanted there to be in a very strict no bailout rule from the start, that didn't happen, but they did have to follow externally set programs. They did have to carry out structural and budgetary policies they didn't want to carry out. And arguably, they're in a much, most of them, if not all of them, are in a much stronger economic position now than they would have been. And all that is due to the fact that there were rules in place. And what made me think of that question was when you talked about how long it took to come to a lot of these agreements. The reason it took such a long time is that you had this, in inverted commas, auto pushback from a number of the northern European states that meant that that at least a portion of the rules were applied. It wasn't the same as the super discretionary policies you had in the UK or the United States. So, yeah, are you being a little harsh?
Good question. Let me start a little bit differently by saying I wouldn't necessarily call the rules that existed very auto-liberal. I mean, it was the idea when we set up the Maastricht Treaty, it was the idea to avoid the emergence of problematic incentives. So this, I mean, that's the classical commitment problem basically that we have. So everyone agrees on something and it looks nice to have a monetary union, but we are not ready to have a monetary union because some adjustment mechanisms don't work. We don't have harmonization of economic policies and all this kind of stuff. And this was certainly not the ideas of the auto-liberals in the 1990s. They were actually opposing the entire monetary union and said, okay, according to this so-called coronation theory, the common currency, that should be the end of a process of European integration. And only at the very end, when we are well integrated, we should have the euro as our common currency. And so most of the auto-liberals who were involved in this debate in the 1980s and 1990s, they would say, well, this is kind of, it helped a little bit, or there was the idea to have at least a little bit of a rule that avoids excessive government spending. But it was, from the start, it was insufficient. And now they, of course, argue that they were proved right, in a sense. What I dislike about much of the discourse, especially on the German side, was that it was claimed that we should follow some auto-liberal rules here, which we were not so much interested in the beginning, and then it was labeled as something auto-liberal. But it was especially the crisis resolution was very much, in my opinion, something that is driven by national interest. It would have been really hard for Angela Merkel to convince the German voters to pay for some other European countries that are in deep economic trouble, which I think was probably not the right answer to this problem. I mean, because I would always argue that the European Union is more than just an economic union. It is also something that is related to solidarity, and it's also especially a peace project. And it seems to me that the new generation of politicians in Germany, but also in other countries, has somehow forgotten that this is the overall aim of the European Union, to be more than just an economic union. Although, of course, economics is really important, but still. So the Germans were harsh, and other European, Northern Europeans were harsh as well on the Southern Europeans. And I wasn't really happy with that.
let me throw in one more thought that is slightly, going off in a different direction. And that is, you know, the question that you asked, Tim, was, aren't we now all, in those countries better off since we followed basically those rules? And some people would say those, order liberally sounding rules. And I think what is important to note is that in order liberal scholarship, there's also a shift away from the self-understanding of the 1980s and 90s that was very expert-driven. You know, these, I would say, slightly older white men thinking about the sensibility of certain rules. But, you know, in doing so, you neglect a scholarship that was really pushed in the 90s and then the 2000s, and Viktor Vandenberg is a very important person in this regard, that said, well, we cannot just talk about the content of rules. We also have to talk about basically the process of legitimation of those rules, right? And how far is it the citizens, the consumers that are sovereign when we talk about those rules, or in how far they imposed. And when we look into, you know, polls that came out after some of those rules that we're now talking about that were implemented in Greece, in Italy, in Spain, etc., you see that people were not just, you know, welcoming those measures, but there was resistance. And the resistance was because of that top-down procedure that was inherent in the setup of, those troika measures. And I think that's important to note, that order liberalism has at its core not just a thinking in rules and order, but at its core is a liberal democratic program. There is a tension there, right? And that it's a tension that goes well beyond order liberalism. If we think about economic expertise more general, we have that tension. But I think it's an important point to mention that when we talk about, is this rule order liberal, we cannot just talk about the form and the content of the rule. We also have to talk about how did this rule come about when we call it order liberal.
No, that's a good point. I mean, several of those countries essentially used, they treated it as an external anchor. So there was no buy-in for the kind of reforms that that they had already pre-agreed to. That brings us to your very interesting conclusion. Between the two of you, you wrote this forward-looking essay, which is based on the following quote: if ordo-liberals want to be relevant in the 21st century, they need to escape pure exegesis of their past heroes, rediscover the reforming spirit of their liberal ideals, and apply them anew to the existing socio-economic challenges in Europe. And you set out this agenda that goes, as you say, goes way beyond just what I think most people would consider to be ordo-liberal policy framework. Could you set out the four big ideas you have here and the underlying problems that you see in European economic structure?
Of course. I start with those four points that you just mentioned, Tim. So what is important to note, and that's a theme in the book, but it's also a theme in the work of Tim and me, that we say, well, you only can understand order liberalism If you clearly understand, you know, the role of institutions and the role of the state as a central player. And that's interesting because it's something that, you know, when you look into other neoliberal scholarship, that's a question that is sometimes neglected or is not, you know, really emphasized. Now, what is the role of the state? Well, we would say, and of, you know, let's say, you know, formal institution more generally. First and foremost, you know, we need non-market institutions to create a functioning market, right? So it is really the state that sort of co-creates a framework of rules which provide basically this order of free, open, and competitive markets. And all those three attributes are important. You know, markets have to be free, meaning basically that it's the market participants that ultimately come up with contracts and the content of contracts. We don't impose them. They have to be open, right? It's not just a few players that define the markets. And they have to be competitive, right? Again, not just two or three big players. Now, apart from that, which is basically more or less, you know, nowadays standard textbook economics, what is important is, and that's the second point of this four-point agenda, is the important notion of power and the dispersion of power that was always, you know, at the center of all the liberal reasoning. That essentially means that the state and government institutions have to be strong enough to resist the influence of special interest groups. And this is obviously a very important point when we think about European institutions and who actually, you know, has a stake in some of those, you know, negotiations that happen in Brussels. So that's a very important second pillar. The third pillar is, and this is something that we, you know, at the beginning of this conversation already mentioned, is that there is a role both on the national, but maybe also on the supranational level for institutions to provide protection against certain socioeconomic hazards in the form of you know, welfare state measures. And there is that protective role. And we think that is essential when we talk about the current crises, because that is something that citizens don't see when they think about liberal economic expertise. And, you know, they don't see that protective role. And we say that's actually inherent in those early order liberal scholars that, you know, we're trying to find an answer to the economic and socioeconomic hazards of the interwar period, but then also the post-World War period. And finally, and that's an important point that we always emphasize, and I just emphasized before, that, you know, those measures that I just talked about are basically constrained by two regulatory ideals. And those ideals are consumer sovereignty and citizen sovereignty. Now, this sounds very abstract, right? Let me just flesh them out a bit. So consumer sovereignty is really that we ultimately have on markets the consumers defining the products that are served, right? It's not, you know, the companies or the state that says what we produce. It's the consumers. And the more difficult idea, but it's essential, I think, for the implementation of all the liberal rules is citizen sovereignty, that it's ultimately, you know, the citizens that participate, that engage in democracy, and that experts listen to when they come up with their policies. Now, before I go on too long, I just want to mention one more point, and that's basically the point that we say, well, if you have those four abstract ideas, you actually can come up with both an economic but also a normative program to tackle some of those pressing socioeconomic issues that we have. And what we identify as the most pressing economic or socioeconomic issue in Europe nowadays is really this tension between, on the one hand, you could call it a fundamental asymmetry between the winners, on the one hand, that are urban, educated, mobile, and losers, on the other hand, that are often in rural areas, socioeconomically disadvantaged, less educated. And the liberal economic order of post-World War II Europe often didn't find answer to tackle this question. And the reason was simple, right? For a couple of decades, we had economic growth. We had basically trickle-down economics on some level that, you know, everybody benefited. But what happened over the last few decades is we saw that implicit social contract falling apart, right? And that we need to, on a European and also national level, to tackle those distributional issues that liberal economists and other liberal scholars often tended to neglect. And that's one of our core points in this chapter.
Right. Just before we come to my final question, I have a pre-final question, which is, you pointed out the differentiation between older ordo-liberal scholars and the people doing the cutting-edge work now. Now, I don't want to be ageist here, but who should we be reading, apart from the two of you, for the most up-to-date, cutting-edge, ordo-liberal scholarship?
Oh, that's a good question, actually. there are, of course, a couple of people working in Germany, sometimes writing in German, but I would say people that I really like are Stefan Kolev, who also wrote mm-hmm. the first chapter in our volume, Niels Goldschmidt, who's one at the end of the book in one of these chapters. These are people who are doing really interesting stuff. And a couple more. Malte, do you have someone you want to add specifically?
No, it's just that what I have, and you touched on this at the beginning of the interview, I was struck at the what seemed to me to be the paucity of literature in English on this subject in recent years. So I'm just looking for listeners to be able to identify who they should look out for.
So my answer, I'm currently teaching and living in the US, and for me, it's interesting to not just look at a narrow German scene that writes narrowly on auto-liberalism, but to broaden the view and go back to some of the stuff that we already mentioned at the beginning of this interview, when we said auto-liberalism was never an isolated intellectual tradition. It was always embedded in a broader international community of scholars, a loose thought collective, you could say, that was always on both sides of the Atlantic. And I think that is actually the most fruitful way, both in terms of, the potential workshop that we organize, but also in terms of scholars to read, to not, look simply at, German faculties and who's there, but to understand who's writing that spirit. And, and this is a point that we also make in our chapter, you have this emerging PPE community, a community of scholars writing in philosophy, politics, and economics, with a yearly conference that tackle a lot of these questions, thinking not just in terms of rules, but how to combine normative reasoning with economic thinking, how to combine thinking about legal institutions with sound economic reasoning and, philosophical justification. And I think that would, for me, be a natural, recommendation for all people who are interested in auto-liberalism to really read widely in this field of PPE. And there you have both fascinating philosophers like Jerry Gauss, who unfortunately passed away recently. You have economists at George Mason University that write in that Buchanan tradition that are very interesting. But of course, you have scholars in Germany that Tim just mentioned, both writing from a historical perspective, but also from a very contemporary perspective on what auto-liberalism should be. So that would be my natural answer to your question, Tim.
Yeah, and it did. Meet my underlying question, I guess, which is there seems to be quite a lot of overlap with the public choice school. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot in English on public choice. Well, to finish, I've asked you both to recommend two books to read, one very broadly in your specialist area, perhaps, and one personal choice. What did you both come up with?
Let me just get or one step back and say one thing. what we still really need Malte just said, okay, take the broad picture, and I was much more narrow in my answer by naming two colleagues. But I think what we really need is a scholarship that combines these two lines. Some people who really show how these different schools relate. And I think that is going to be a challenge for the next years, to really work out these linkages between the different schools and to show that these people are really working on very similar issues, but use very different ideas and works and so on to come to similar results. I just wanted to say that. And regarding the two books, I have, of course, one book. I haven't read it yet, but I'm going to read it over the summer. And that is Kenneth Dyson, Conservative Liberalism, Auto-Liberalism and the State, Disciplining Democracy and the Market. And I'm especially interested in the question that you already mentioned, Tim. Why is auto-liberalism a conservative liberalism, as Kenneth Dyson argues here? And why is it not a social or left liberalism? And that's something I want to understand. But first, I need to understand, of course, why it's mostly a conservative liberalism. And a little bit broader than that, or my personal recommendation, because I'm just reading this book and it's really fascinating, that's Robert S. Taylor, Exit Left, Markets and Mobility in Republican Thought. This is very interesting because it combines these ideas of Albert Hirschman with also issues that I'm interested in as an auto-liberal. It's much about exit and competition, but in very different perspectives, like in the family and so on. And it's a really fascinating book. And that's something I can really recommend.
Okay, thank you.
Well,
and Malte,
about you? Thanks. So let me start with the book that is more, in line with auto-liberalism and the book and basically the theme of the book we've just talked about. That's Darren Acemoglu and James Robinson, The Narrow Corridor: How Nations Struggle for Liberty. As published, I think, in 2019. Now, that's obviously a very, widely read book, a very popular, you could say a bestseller. But I think it's very interesting if one reads it with an auto-liberal lens and asks oneself, what can we as, people writing an auto-liberal tradition learn from this more Anglo-American tradition that tackle very similar questions? And the core question of the book is, when, historically speaking, over the last, 5,000 years, did societies emerge that were free, where basically there was a certain balance, and they call that the Red Queen effect in the book, a balance between state on the one hand and civil society on the other hand. And the central question of the book is really, how can power be dispersed? And that's a very auto-liberal question, but it's tackled in a very refreshingly Anglo-American way, spanning nearly 5,000 years, and also very empirical. And I think auto-liberal scholars can learn a lot from that. Now, on a more personal note, I recommend Amartya Sen's book, The Idea of Justice. And again, I think it's interesting if one reads that book and thinks about how can an economist like Amartya Sen write a book on philosophy. And I think, and Amartya Sen is, obviously famous for that, and he's one of the few who's excellent in doing that. But I think, and this is a topic that Tim and I also tend to mention in our articles, auto-liberals shouldn't shy away from normative reasoning, from defending certain core liberal values, and to, basically go down a similar path like Amartya Sen did. And Sen was quite successful. And I think all the liberals should do something similar with their background and not totally go down that technical route and become all econometricians. Having said this, nothing's wrong with econometrics, but I think there's something appealing and charming in the auto-liberal traditions. That is their unique selling point, and they shouldn't lose that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you both. Very interesting. Today, I've been talking to Malte Dold and Tim Krieger about their auto-liberalism and European economic policy. Thank you both for coming on.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much, Tim. It was a pleasure talking to you.